Math is a wonderful thing. Math is a really cool thing. So get off your ass, let's do some math. Math, 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 math.
Nearly everyone did better under this program.
And they all did a lot better.
Why, hello there, Pip Around listeners. You might hear that the environment is slightly different than that which it is normally during our podcast. If you're hearing different sounds, that's because I'm no longer in Washington, D.C., where I normally report from during the podcast. I'm in the North London neighborhood of Stoke Newington. Now, the question is, why am I here right now? You'll just have to wait and see. So, welcome to Paper Round, the show that moves your understanding of development research two standard deviations to the right.
And if you don't understand that now, you will by the end of the show.
So, I'm now sitting in Ranald's home in Stoke Newington, in North London. We are now face-to-face for the first time in a couple of years.
Yeah, 18 months at least.
18 months, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot has changed.
A lot has changed, yeah. In many ways, Ranald is half the man that he used to be.
Well, thank you. I'm getting definitely half the sleep I used to get, if that. And I spent double the time cleaning up after the whirlwind that my wife and I have brought into this world. Hurricane Luca.
So it's fitting that today's set of papers that we're going to talk about have to do with getting children to learn, because in the interim, since I've seen Ranald, he and his wife have produced a little boy.
Thank you. Yes, we had a kid. And like all normal parents, we have already, you know, he's about 11 months old now, about to turn one, actually. We have already started stressing about schools and learning and nurseries and all that. In fact, today he's at nursery. And at some point during the show, we're going to have to walk over to his nursery and collect him. Actually, not too long from now. And hopefully he will have stopped crying since the time I dropped him off. His nursery is awesome. His nursery workers are awesome. But no child likes to be away from their parents this early in life.
So you find us, this is a few days into September 2021. We're in London at the kind of, hopefully the tail end of the pandemic. Give everyone a sense of when it is. So Ranald, you're now thinking about education for your kid. That, of course, makes you like every single parent all over the world. Of course, here in London, you probably have a number of choices as to where Luca is going to go for preschool and kindergarten and everything that comes after that. Which gang he joins, right. You have to figure out which tattoo parlor he's going to frequent the most. But there are some places in the world where there's just very little in terms of provision of schooling. You live somewhere that the state has not yet managed to provide a school. Either they don't provide it or it's going to be low quality. And so there's a large proportion of children around the world that just don't have access to good education.
Increasingly, they have access to a school, right? They're in a school, but
they're not learning.
Yeah. I mean, learning's not the only thing that has to happen in a school, right? No. You get socialized. It's a safe place for children to be for a certain number of hours a day.
Right.
And they do physical development, et cetera, and so forth. But it's a pretty big thing. It's a big chunk of what makes a school a school.
And some of these places, it's not only that kids aren't learning, but they're not learning the very fundamental things you pick up in education. They come out of school unable to read or write or do very, very simple arithmetic.
Right. And yeah. It's quite feasible that you come out of a sort of econometrics class and you're still using antiquated difference in difference estimators. However, that's not the kind of thing that we're talking about here. It's not like that. I mean, like, we're talking about kids who come out of school unable to read a basic sentence, maybe even a basic word.
Yeah. These are areas where there's just very, very, very low levels of learning. These schools are not providing that very basic function. And so that brings us to the two papers we're going to talk about today, which have overlap in their authors, but are we going to say all the author names? Okay.
Yeah, we can't possibly name all the authors. So take up the whole running time of the presentation of the
No, we should because it's right to say all the authors. So The two papers are very closely related. They share some of the same co-authors. The first is a paper that came out recently in the journal Public Economics called Large Learning Gains in Pockets of Extreme Poverty, Experimental Evidence from Guinea-Bissau. And that's been written by Ila Fazio, Alex Ebel, Robin Lumsdane, Peter Boone, Babukar Bui, Peijing Jenny Tse, Chitra Chitra.
I can do that one. Okay. That's definitely in my... Chitra Jayanti, Simon Johnson, and Ana Filipa Silva.
Here we go. And then we're also going to discuss a related paper.
That one is called... How Much Can We Remedy Very Low Learning Levels in Rural Parts of Low-Income Countries? Impact and Generalizability from a Multi-Pronged Parateacher Intervention from a Cluster Randomized Trial in the Gambia. Don't worry, we're going to upload these both onto the website. And that one is written by Alex Ebel, Chris Frost, Alpha Kamara, Bubakar Bui, Mamadou Ba, Maitri Sivaraman, Peicheng Jenny Cie, Chitra Jayanti, Tony Brady, Peter Goron.
Yeah.
And then this one, how would I pronounce that? That's a Dutch name, and I don't...
I have no idea.
That looks Skin. Like Stein van Steelen.
Yeah, Stein van Steelen. Sounds good.
Peter Boone and Diana Elborn. Goodness me, I'm out of breath.
So you would have heard that these two papers share a large number of co-authors, and they actually share a lot of the same DNA in both the context, but also in the approach. This is a case where we're starting out with villages that have very little in the way, either very little in the way of actual school provision, or the schools that are being provided just aren't resulting in very many kids that have learned very much.
There's a lot in common between the papers. The authors, the structure, the key result.
Right.
And the number of pages.
Right. And that so we'll get into it, but both of these involve injecting a high amount of resources into these villages, new teachers, and the teachers will differ in their actual quality or in how much training they received. But we're talking about interventions that are involve injecting several hundred dollars per kid per year into these places and trying to pull them from a space of kind of a learning trap. If we want to go back to the poverty trap episode that we had at the beginning of the show, these are kids that are in some form of learning trap. They haven't learned anything and trying to drastically increase how much they've learned. And despite the fact the papers involve slightly different contexts and slightly different interventions, they get very similar results in terms of their impact on these child's learning outcomes. So in terms of framing, you know, we started by asking this question, like, why in some of these places around the world are learning levels so low? Why are there places in the world where children can't read a basic sentence or do very simple arithmetic? And one of the enduring questions in development, especially development economics, is to what extent is this due to demand side factors? You know, the kids themselves, you know, maybe they lack nutrition, maybe they lack the ability to really learn anything, maybe their parents aren't willing to invest in them to the degree that's necessary for them to learn a lot. And how much of this is supply constraints, both the presence of schools, but also good quality schools, ones that will actually lead kids to learn. So teachers that are investing in them, well-structured curricula and the like. These are the questions that these two papers are trying to tackle in two different sub-Saharan African countries, but one that both struggle with this problem of very low levels of learning.
Can I interject for a second?
Yeah.
So when we're talking about supply constraints, it's important to be clear that these supply constraints aren't necessarily just about schools, right?
Sure.
You know, there's a whole learning environment, and, you know, you think a lot about parents and the home environment mattering a lot for totally. How much children learn, because, you know, you ask your kid at the end of the day, what did you do at school today? Oh, did you know this? Did you know that? Oh, interesting. What did they say? You discuss stuff like that, right?
I think that would be put on the demands. Well, again, it's not the demand for education, but it's the complementary inputs that a parent provides.
Yeah, so a supply thing, right?
Supply in the sense of supplying inputs. Yeah, that is true.
Supply, to supply the learning environment.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's a question as to whether or not that lack of supply of complementary inputs from parents is coming from a low lack of demand, or a lack of knowledge, which would be a supply thing.
Exactly. Or, the reason I raise it as well, actually, is that when we dig into these papers, you'll see that like 75% of the parents in the sample can't read a single word, a single short word. So, I mean, we're talking about sort of Like, you get learning tests. These are learning Saharas. Yeah.
There is no point in the in the average day that these kids go through, there's no point in which they're really being exposed to an environment that's conducive to learning, right? So the two countries are one is Guinea-Bissau and the other is the Gambia. And both of these papers involve going to, I think, fairly rural locations.
Fairly rural locations, yes.
And in the case of Guinea-Bissau, finding places where there is little to no schooling taking place, also no involvement from the third sector, from the nonprofit sector. But in the case of the Gambia, finding places where kids are actually going to school during most of the day, they're just not learning anything.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about the kind of interventions that they're providing?
So, I mean, essentially what they do is, it feels like they started this project by saying, what do we think is going to work? And let's just throw everything that we think will make a big difference to these kids learning their lives. And they settle on three interventions that I think are trials that they settle on three interventions, which are they bundle together. One is training parateachers, which is basically, how would you describe parateachers?
Are parateachers the ones that parachute in from airplanes?
No. You're thinking of paratroopers.
Okay, gotcha.
A parateacher is, I think, a ancillary teacher, sort of instructor or a who is not part of the school teaching system, but is a supplementary teacher. And the second thing is that they give these paratroopers. I said paratrooper, did you notice that?
Yeah. Okay.
They give these parateachers a script. They do scripted learning, which is, you know, not a million miles away from this, what bridge academies do, you know.
Yeah.
And then the third thing they do is that they monitor the heck out of the parateachers. Like, they really look in and sort of follow up with them to make sure that they have imbibed everything they were trained in, to make sure that they're delivering the right classes, etc. and so forth. And they basically, in the Gambia paper, what they do is they set up these after-school clubs, essentially. And these after-school clubs are characterized by these three inputs: the scripted learning, the parateachers, and the parateachers being closely monitored. And there's a sort of, it's quite intensive. There's a number of hours a week, I believe. And they do this to complement what's being learned in the school, but they are not formally engaged with the school system. So in the Gambia experiment, they're not working hand in hand with the government or the public school system. And in the Guinea-Bissau paper, it's something slightly different, isn't it?
In terms of the involvement of the government, there's not a whole lot. The government did look at the curriculum that they were using. In the Guinea-Bissau paper, they also train these parateachers. But this is an environment where suddenly you have some people who, I guess, weren't doing a whole lot before the intervention. Suddenly you got all these new skills that turn them into these, you know, very high-performing parateachers. And so what did they do? They decided to try and extract more higher wages from the research team. As it's described in the paper, this led to a legal fight between the research team and the group of parateachers that they had trained, which resulted in the research team winning in the courts, the Guinea-Bissau courts, and then firing the entire troop of parateachers. So they had to start again, and I think, having learned your lesson, they instead took existing teachers or people who had gone through proper teacher training and kind of retrained them using this new curriculum and these new methods, which also involved having to pay them a little bit more than you would have done with just a standard set of parateachers.
And just to comment on that whole situation, I teach procurement at BSG some years, and that is a classic example of the hold-up problem. So essentially what happens is the training they gave the teachers meant that in a situation where there were very few other people who already had those skills, gave the parateachers a huge amount of leverage over the researchers, and the parateachers had outside options because they could now become school teachers or whatever, whereas the experimental team only had those 48 people who they trained. So perhaps they should have had a procurement specialist in there, a contracting specialist in there as well.
There's finally one other, maybe a fourth aspect of the intervention, which I don't think is talked about much in either paper, but just jumps out of the summary statistics. And that is, these are, I think, fairly small class sizes that we're talking about. They're usually like 30 to 40 children, which sounds like quite high by, you know, kind of standards that you see in
fewer, surely, right?
What?
Oh, yes. No, you're right. Yes, absolutely. Sorry. There's a floor as well. The floor in the Gambia paper is at least 10 eligible children. I think the floor...
That's
in
the village cutoff.
In the village, yeah.
Right. No, but I'm talking about just like the resulting class sizes are quite small.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay, yeah, yeah. I understand, yeah.
Which just means that, like, you know, compared to what you would get in normal public school, like, these kids are getting a lot more attention, which is, in like, one of the kind of things that leaps out of the economics of education literature is that small class sizes just on like, almost, I think it's uncontroversial to say that low class sizes are good.
Bucket.
So you can probably hear the sounds, the goo-goo and gogging of Luca, little Luca, Ranald's son. We've just picked him up from his daycare, from the nursery, as they say over here. And we've just come back to Ranald's place.
Careful.
Because... as many a parent will attest, it can be a little bit difficult juggling both recording, and child caring at the same time. We're going to finish the rest of this podcast the old-fashioned way, online over Zoom.
Yeah.
Apologies for the change in sound tone that you're about to hear, but otherwise we'll continue talking as we normally do.
Yeah, I guess we'll probably wind up using bits of our chat now across the different podcasts. Basically, half this podcast is going to be a hybrid podcast. Anyway, thanks for coming up, Matt. Thanks for keeping me company when I was getting Luca from nursery.
Of course, yeah.
It's been great to see you.
It's been great seeing you too. So, welcome back. Ranald and I, we have to admit to you, have been recording this podcast on and off for a few months now. So, a few seconds ago, we were actually in the same room in London, and now we have an ocean between us again. So, we're staring at each other longingly over a Zoom call instead of being in the same place.
Yeah, and we've gone from the summer. I think the last time I saw you, I was wearing shorts. And now I am wearing, like, 8 jumpers because, you know, British weather sucks. So where were we, Matt? I think we were talking about the two Ebel AR papers, yeah, where we just gotten to the point where we were describing what they did. And we talked a little bit about how they were held up by the teachers who they trained in Guinea-Bissau and how they won in what I imagine to be a sort of courtroom scene reminiscent of A Few Good Men, with Alex Abel shouting out, "You can't handle the truth!
You can't handle the truth!"
to the supply teachers. But we haven't actually spoken very much about the interventions that they ran and
yeah,
the impact it had.
So should we start briefly with Guinea-Bissau and then we can go on to the Gambia? In Guinea-Bissau, we may have mentioned this before, it's worth noting that they intentionally sought out regions of the country that were not being served by anyone, by the government or by NGOs. And that latter bit's going to be important because it might change how we think about the impacts of these interventions. I think what's kind of somewhat unique about these papers, is, or at least this one in particular, is we often look at these education RCTs and they're usually changing one thing, right? And in this case, they're bringing a whole package of things that we think matter from the previous literature together. So what they brought were teachers that were recruited, but they're being paid quite a lot of money. There's scripted lessons. So instead of the teacher kind of developing their own curriculum and taking the students through it, they have a script that the teacher follows. I assume they can deviate it from time to time. But it's a technology that allows for an enormous amount of standardization in how curriculum is being delivered. And they had their own new curriculum, which they had imported from was it India, Ranald? I can't remember where the curriculum was taken from, but
yeah. So the setup of the intervention mirrors something that had been tried in India and was found to work in India, but with, I'm not going to say modest results, but relatively modest results. And that relatively is doing a lot of work here, as we will come to in a few moments.
And then finally, the teachers that were recruited amongst people that had ability to speak the local language. So these are people that can then teach kids in their local language at the same time. And all these things together weren't cheap. So I wrote down that the total cost of the program in Guinea-Bissau was about $425 per child per year, which is about just over, it's about $1.15, $1.16 a day per kid, which is quite a lot if you think about these are people that are largely living under a poverty line that is $1.90 per day. So this is a substantial intervention relative to the amount of money you would need to transfer to families to start getting them above the poverty line. So yeah, that's the bare bones of the intervention in Guinea-Bissau.
Yeah. And so, and one thing worth noting in Guinea-Bissau is because there's no there's nothing else going on in these places really, they are essentially setting up schools with these teachers.
Yeah.
That's different to what they do in the Gambia. What they do in the Gambia is they're setting up after-school clubs, often in the very buildings that the schoolhouse has provided with the full knowledge and cooperation of the local school and so on. And in Guinea-Bissau, and this probably reflects differences in the labour market as well as the fact that they're not setting up a whole school themselves, the cost per child is substantially lower. It's like $240 per child per year. That's still pretty, that's a pretty expensive intervention. That's a damn expensive intervention, in fact. But it reflects something that I think about a lot, which is that the external validity of a cost estimate is normally sort of not that great. I mean, you need to, there's a lot of real circumstance that goes into determining how much an intervention costs. But in the Gambia, it's after school clubs, and in Guinea-Bissau, they're setting up schools. And I think one thing I should say about the scripted learning thing, I had a conversation with my colleague Susanna Hares, who knows basically everything there is to know about education and education interventions in the developing world. And she suggested to me that most of the time when people say script, they mean template. However, there are some kinds of schools which do use scripts, like where we're talking about, you know, you have a screenplay in front of you and a writer-director auteur, like, who's an annoying writer-director? There's got to be... Who could I think of? Who's the kind of writer-director? Like David O. Russell. He's going to have a massive tantrum if you don't use the exact punctuation in his in his screenplay. So there are a couple of schools that do that. I'm not going to name any names. Cough, Bridge. But then there are a few others that have templates, which is this is the format of your lesson. These are the things you need to hit. And so on.
Okay, so they do this intervention, but they also go to, they do a survey at the same time, so they have a comparison group of kids who didn't receive this bundled intervention in Guinea-Bissau. And I think the one thing is worth noting, and this is not a very profound point, but as we're going to see in a moment, the results are similar across both interventions, despite the context being quite different, right? In one case, you're really starting from nothing. And so in some ways, it's not that surprising that you find a result, right? If you start with nothing, it's kind of easy. There's high returns at a low level of education, and there's no one else in these villages providing anything. So providing something is going to get you somewhere. So in some ways, the results from the Guinea-Bissau intervention are not quite as impressive as the Gambia one, where like you're providing a very limited intervention, both in time and scale, in addition to what these kids are already doing. And so either that means that like there's more low-hanging fruit for kids in terms of learning, or that the main schooling they're getting is just like useless, right? Like the other way to read it is that in the Gambia, the kids in the Gambia who are going to school most of the day are getting the same level of education as the kids in Guinea-Bissau who have no access to schooling, which doesn't speak well of the public schooling system.
Yeah, and that wouldn't massively surprise anybody who follows the literature on education in developing countries, would it?
No.
Right? I mean, there's a paper called Schooling Ain't Learning, isn't there?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that's a, I mean, I said this earlier, but worth repeating, learning's not the only thing about schooling, but it is a pretty big thing in schooling.
Sure.
Let's talk about that. So you're saying, like, it's a surprise, it's really impressive that the results are similar. So why don't we talk about, like, how big are these results? Because there's, I mean, this is one time when doing a podcast just does not do justice to the paper. It's right. A little bit like a little callback to our first episode where we were trying to describe the visual image of a poverty trap in in word. Now we're trying to describe two distributions of scores, one for the people who get the intervention and one for the people who don't get the intervention. And Matt, do you want to?
So I mean, no, I mean, I'll have a go at it, and then maybe you can have a better way of putting it. But I was just thinking about it now. It's a little bit like, imagine you're watching like the 100-meter dash, right? And so often you watch these things, and like someone, the winning person will just be winning by a couple of inches, right? They'll get across the finish line, but you have to look at the slow motion video to see who won. It's usually just a slight win, and then this is the equivalent of like the Usain Bolt version of that, right? Like he's clearly, one of this intervention is clearly won heads and shoulders above everything else. So I mean, maybe that's not the right way of describing overlapping distributions, but like usually you have to really tease out these effects. In this case, it's super clear that this has had a massive impact.
I have lived to see everything. Matthew Collin used a sports analogy. I mean, like something more on brand for paper round. It's like the control villagers are, you know, you could put them in a fight and they're a bit like Bruce Banner. The treatment villagers are the Hulk. So what happens is, like, you can basically, in economics we use these things, well, actually in most, many disciplines, we use these things called histograms, where you, more or less, you basically say, for every little group of scores that you might get in a paper, let's say your paper gets scored from 0, your test gets scored from 0 to 100, right? You can group together, say, all the scores from 0 to 5, and you count up all the number of people who got 0 to 5, and then you count the people who get from 5 to 10, and from 10 to 15, and so on, and all the way up to 100. In the control group, what you observe is that the students overwhelmingly are scoring in the lowest scoring categories. They're all in the 0 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 15 group. And you get these really big, tall bars, and they're tall because there are lots of people in each of those bins. In the treatment group, nobody's in those places. Everybody is on the other end. There are the people who are scoring their 70s and 80s on these tests. And to give you a sense of how big an effect that is, it's a bit like taking somebody in your class who is failing all his exams, giving them an after-school program, and then for those people to be acing all of those exams. It's a huge transformation, and it's a kind of transformation that you don't typically see on any kind of outcome in any kind of development intervention.
And just to put another point on that, like normally when you see these improvements from these programs in these, you know, in randomized controlled trials, the distribution has shifted a little bit, which tells you that either a handful of people did much better or everyone did a little bit better on average, but that's kind of it. Where this is clear that nearly everyone did better under this program.
And they all did a lot better.
They all did a lot better. So, I mean, this is the equivalent, and I'm going to use this analogy again, if anyone's seen the Edward James Olmos movie, Stand and Deliver, where he shows up, this like charismatic math teacher shows up and gets a class of disadvantaged kids in LA to all score top marks on the calculus AP exam, which is based on a true story. But that's a case where like the entire distribution moved from failing to passing. And that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, I mean, it's spectacular. And calling back to what Matt opened this episode with, so you can characterize the gains made by an intervention like this in terms of something called standard deviations. I'm not going to go into all the stats around this, but if you say that there is a, say, 0.2 standard deviation increase in your outcome of interest, let's say in this case this is your scores in a maths test, a 0.2 increase standard deviation in your outcome of interest means that there is a little bit of a shift in the distribution, just a little nudge in that shift of distribution up to higher scores. And that would be considered a success, right? A 0.2 SD intervention, like an intervention that increases scores by 0.2 SD would be, you know, you'd be like, yeah, I'm happy with that. That works.
Yeah.
This intervention is creating gains of
2, 3 standard deviations. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You get these massive effects from either building a whole new school in this Sahara of learning where nobody knows anything, or going to places which have schools and adding the after-school class using the same basic methodology. So this is not dependent, or at least it did not seem to be dependent on just picking on, like, on just, like, providing schooling to people who are otherwise getting nothing, right? It works even when the basic infrastructure of education provision is in place. It does indicate, however, that that basic infrastructure is totally dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Right? But the point being that, like, the Guinea-Bissau intervention is in a place that's unusual even by developing country standards. The Gambia intervention is not. It's much more typical. And it works in both.
So, Randall, how does this make us think differently? What do we do with this, right? I guess I feel like the authors don't end, I could get this wrong, so tell me if you've read it differently. The authors don't seem to really embrace much of a discussion of the policy implications of this intervention, despite it having potentially massive policy implications, right? Like, the holy grail of education policy in these countries is to get kids to read and write and to do basic maths, which is what they've accomplished here. Yet there doesn't seem to be a clear path from this really intensive intervention run by a bunch of really smart, really attentive researchers with a lot of money to one in which you can scale this up across the entire country and bring the rest of the children who are in school up to speed to this level. I don't see a path charted in the papers, and I'm curious to know what you think about what that path might be, or even if there is really a path. Is this just showing us that in a very special circumstance, at a certain scale, it's possible to do this? A little bit like agronomists can show us with a plot of land, if you put the inputs just in right and the weather is just perfect, you can get a certain yield in your crops. You know, I guess the question is this like agriculture? Can you take these inputs that have been shown to work and just apply them to a lot more land and get the same results? Or is there something constraining our ability to do that?
Interestingly, I'm doing a lot of thinking about agriculture for some other work, CGD at the moment. And one of the interesting things about agriculture is that actually, yeah, you have these test crops, test fields, you know, these demonstration fields. And very often, actually, what looks amazing in the demonstration field doesn't work in other places because there's just so much that intervenes. Could that be the case here? I don't know, but I suspect so. And actually, I would like to say, I want to put it like this, actually. The way that I have seen most of the framing around this paper is that, and that's reading the papers and also the discussions on Twitter and so on, has been, first of all, look, we can actually make a massive difference to people's education in the worst places in the world for education. Like, we can take terrible, terrible outcomes and make them pretty good outcomes if you're willing to put in enough money and effort into doing so. Which is, I think that's absolutely true.
That's also, I should note, really important because when we think about, you know, if you think about the inputs to education, to human capital, you know, there are school inputs, there are environmental inputs, and then there's the kind of characteristics of the kids. And what this shows is that, like, there's nothing wrong with these children, right? Like, these children, once you give them the right environment, will thrive. So it's not that, you know, I'm sure there's other complementary things, you know, health interventions and whatnot that would actually make things even better. But it's clear that if you just put them in a good environment, they're going to learn. So it's not these kids' fault that they're not learning anything. It's a failure of the state to provide the right kind of environment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. And it also matters because, like, one way of thinking about this result then is that you can say, what if we took all the money from all the stuff that doesn't work, we close every one laptop per child in the world, and we count up all that money, how many times could we implement this, right? You could immediately say that you could, at the very least, redistribute resources from stuff we know that doesn't work, but is nevertheless being tried and being spent on, to this kind of intervention full-time, and then we make a massive improvement to some very unfortunate people's lives. So that's one way of thinking about it, and that's great. The other way of thinking about this is that, you know, it's set up in a way that encourages us to think that it's replicable, even if it's not being fully pushed as a cookie cutter intervention. Because, you know, the whole point of scripting here is to make it easy to roll out to other people. You still need to train teachers and so on and so forth, right? But theoretically, you should be able to apply this kind of intervention in multiple settings. So it should encourage us to think about the possibility of scaling this up. But there are a couple of barriers, a couple of things to think about, a couple of reasons why we might think that that's an optimistic reading of how this all works. So the first thing is that when you scale stuff up and you replicate it, a lot changes. And there is a limit to what you can control. I can control the script. Yes, sure you can. Mm. You can't control the populations receiving the treatment in the same way. If you move to different kinds of students and different kinds of settings, you can reasonably expect that maybe in some settings the intervention results would be even bigger. Maybe in many other settings the intervention results would be smaller, right? Maybe the cost doesn't change as much as the benefits do with scale. Perhaps the cost increases something like linearly with scale, but the benefits they start to taper off, right? Which would indicate then that you don't just want to scale up this intervention all the way up to cover every student in a developing country. It would indicate that you want to use this intervention for certain subpopulations and then do other stuff for other places, right? And there is no good sense. And I mean, like, I should clarify, I'm not criticizing the paper for not having this, because it's way beyond what any paper in almost any part of development economics I've ever seen has ever done. But there's no sense of knowing what that stopping point is, right? So that's the first thing, right?
Yeah.
The second reason why you might see failures of scale up is that the institutional structures that govern an intervention change with scale, right? When you're doing two pilots,
yeah,
even quite large pilots, you know, this is a cluster randomized trial, they're going to a not insignificant number of villages in both of these countries. You have brilliant researchers involved in the management team. You have a lot of interest in checking at different stages, is this going how we thought it would go? Is this being implemented correctly? And so on. And you have people who are invested in success involved at every stage of the pilot in these early stage, in these sort of studies, right? Once you go from that, for it being implemented through the mainstream of any kind of state apparatus, you have a different set of people who are doing the implementation. Some may not give a damn. Some may give a damn. Yeah. Some may give a damn, but have three other jobs to go to handle as well. You know.
Then you're at the whim of politics as well, right? And if there's any sort of, you know, patronage going on, and certain districts receiving more of an allocation than others, that opens the door for that. But also, like, so we also know, right, that these inputs can be provided at scale in some contexts through the private sector. And this is probably the bit of the conversation that will get us yelled at Twitter by everyone we know who knows more about this than at least I do. So, I mean, the other group that can potentially do this, and there are examples of this, is the private sector at providing education at scale. But I think where we get nervous there is where private school chains may have the technology to do this. The incentive structure is different, right? And if it's a for-profit enterprise, they may not necessarily be wanting to reach those ill-served students in the middle of nowhere in Guinea-Bissau, right? It may not be cost-effective for them, or once they arrive, if their incentive structure is such, they may not necessarily want to get to every student. So I think that's the concern about scale in that context.
So some of these schools want to make it look like they're like Harvard, right?
Right.
And they actually celebrate the fact that once you control for the people who we selected to get into this school, look how great our results are. But that is anathema to what Ebel and all are trying to do, because they want to find the people who are not going to get into Harvard that are at the bottom of the learning distribution and get them good enough to get into Harvard. Like, I mean, that's an exaggeration, but, you know, this is total difference in mentality there. But it's fair to say that, you know, the other way we should think about, like, the scaling, the question of scaling on this thing, is that, right, so first of all, we've got two-point estimates of the cost in different countries, and at different scales, precisely. We don't know what the cost function for this intervention looks like. We just know that 2-point estimates are both very, very high cost per student. Right? It could be that the cost function is such that at scale, it would decline substantially or increase substantially or be very similar or whatever, right? But the point is that from what we know, it is so much more expensive than everything else we do in education.
Yeah.
That even if we were to reallocate the full education budget just to doing this intervention, which again, wouldn't be justified even on its own terms because learning's not the only thing that you want to do, in this, but it is the main thing that they're studying here. You wouldn't be able to cover a small fraction of the number of students who are currently reached.
Yeah.
Or the number of potential students who are currently reached by various education interventions. And that should also give us pause, right? Because like, it's not obvious that it's the same to me that we achieve massive gains in a few people versus small gains in a lot of people. There are some contexts in which I would prefer option one and some which you would prefer option two, right? It's not obvious that, like a pure utilitarian might say, all I care about is gain per person. I'm not sure that's a fair characterization.
Well, it also depends on what you think the relationship between education and welfare is, right? If you're Francis Thiel, a professor of ours, he always maintained that the returns to education were convex, right? In that case, it makes sense to push a few people really, really far rather than nudge everyone along a little bit. So I guess that's one of the things you have to interrogate first, right? What do you think this is going to do for welfare? Let's abstract away from that a little bit. Does it make sense to get a few people in your country from completing primary school to completing secondary school? Or does it make sense to get everyone to complete primary school? And that depends a little bit on whether or not you think the benefit to getting people over the next hump is so much greater that it offsets the minor benefit of getting everyone to the first point. So
yeah. And this also sort of, like, again, like, so that returns function that matters. It's also like your weighting of it, the equity.
Sure.
That should also sort of like form part of your utility function.
I mean, we're economists and we like to think about, you know, where the low hanging fruit is, where the returns are greatest. I mean, I think a lot of people working in the education space would take a firmer stance. You're probably going to push back on this, but I'd like to put it out there anyway, that in a country, everyone should be able to read and write and do basic arithmetic. And like, there's kind of almost a human rights element to it where, you know, that's a worthy objective in and of itself before we think about the next steps.
Why do you think I was going to push you back on that?
Oh, because you're a cold-hearted homo economicus at the end of the day, Randall.
No, I mean, like, I'm reading a Murchison's autobiography at the moment, right? Like, I buy into the human rights aspect to this as well. Like, there is definitely an element of that which is true. There is a human dignity aspect to it.
But I mean, but at the same time, yeah, the but is when conditional and limited resources, where do you want the most human dignity, right? Or what provides you the most human dignity, if that's your outcome of interest, right?
Yeah. No, exactly, right? Like, so I'm not going to pretend I've thought enough about this specific question to have a very, very firmly held view. My instinct leans towards preferring broader-based changes across broader-based but smaller changes, if that is the trade-off. But let's be Bayesian and call that, like, a loosely held prior. I'm not at all certain that that's right. And if I thought about it, probably even for another 5 minutes, I might change my mind.
Loosely held priors would have been a good alternative name for this podcast.
That's a really good, yeah, that's true, yeah. Well, you know, Richard Pryor's autobiography was called Prior Convictions.
Yeah.
I always thought that was genius. That, what would you expect to happen when you scale this up? There are some philosophical ones as well. Then there's another sort of institutional one, in a sense, which is that...
Yeah.
Globally, education funding is fairly atomized, right? There's money coming from philanthropists, from NGOs, from donor governments, from domestic governments, which is, I think, the largest chunk of it, obviously, even in developing countries, and so on. Mm. And with that atomization comes sort of different preferences, different sort of like different donors, and they like different projects, different approaches, different ways of doing things. They have different ideas about what the optimal portfolio should look like. So there's like, I guess this institutional question is also, even if, let's say you get a group of wonks in a room and they all decided that the Able AL intervention is the way, it's the future for education interventions in developing country. Like, you could probably only bring a certain number of donors with you, and it would severely limit how much you could, how far you could push it. And this is generally true, I think, for all aspects of development spending. So, very expensive interventions require very large amounts of resources. In aggregate, there are large amounts of resources available. You know, less so than we would like, but nevertheless, like, large amounts of resources are available. But no one has the magic wand where they can just reallocate the resources. And so, again, like, there's a question of, like, how useful is it to know that you could do something extremely good, extremely expensively within that institutional setup? I mean, like, I'm asking the question hypothetically. I think it's extremely useful to know, and I really, really love these papers, which is why we're talking about them. But it's, you know, it should make us stop and think a bit about how this is all structured.
Definitely. I guess there's two parts to it, right? There's one is this a best practice that should be adopted by, you know, use the word atomized, but every atom in education spending. And I think a little bit about, and I'm not sure how much this has progressed, but I think there's now a growing consensus that in the space of humanitarian aid, that cash is better. Giving people cash directly is well preferred to anything that you could be providing in kind. And I think there's a lot of good evidence behind it, and I think a lot of people have begun to adopt that as a method. I could be wrong. I'm sure our humanitarian-focused colleagues will tell us that it's no longer a thing or not as big of a thing as I'm saying. But that's a case of convincing people that the technology is right, where this is different in that in the humanitarian case, you're basically saying, take the same amount of money you're spending on stuff and give it in cash instead. And this is saying, is both a reallocation issue of like, take what you're spending on all these other education interventions, instead start doing, you know, schools and difficult to find places or after school clubs. But it's also a scale up at the same time, right? It's moving from, I'm not sure what the global spending per child is in these countries on average, but it's definitely less than $450 a year, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. Exactly. You're exactly right. And also, I would say that the technological jump that they're asking for is very much bigger than the jump from stuff to cash, I think.
This is a dumb aside, maybe, but if we do believe that, like, these programs that are organized by academics at top universities, if we believe there's an effect on the, you know, of their involvement on the effectiveness of these programs, shouldn't we, like, be hiring these people to run development programs? Like, I guess, is there something special about these particular types of people, you know, incredibly intrinsically motivated to have a top publication, that you wouldn't be able to transfer it to the context of, like, just providing education for the sake of education? And I don't want to say that Ebel and Crowd don't care about education. They obviously do. I just mean the incentive structure is slightly different than a development bureaucrat.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that's an aside. I think that's actually kind of central. I once gave a presentation where I used this exact example. Like, you know, we in DFID might run a training program for entrepreneurs, right? And we expected to have, you know, X results or whatever. And I gave the example that, like, you know, David McKenzie's done a bunch of these and he generally finds really, really small results. You're not as smart as David McKenzie, you know. You're not as smart as Chris Woodruff, right? Neither am I. That's okay.
Right.
You know, you either think you have a massive advantage in the logistics of all this, right? Or, right, and so, but generally, like, there's another way of thinking about this, actually, which is, Lan Pritchard recently wrote a piece about Rukmini Banerjee, she's implemented a whole bunch of education interventions, right? So she works at Pratham. She's done all these RCTs in collaboration with people like Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo and so on and so forth. And they're not implementing it, right? That she's implementing it, her team are implementing it, BRAC implement, Pratham implement, right? And they're damn good at implementing, right? The academics are there to help them have like helped them think in a disciplined, precise manner about their theory of change, about the mechanisms, and about the sort of how should we conceive of what success means in this kind of context? How would we measure it? And that thinking stuff helps the brilliant practitioner hone what they want to implement. I feel like it's probably something similar going on here with the Ebel and Orr paper. And maybe I'm wrong, right? But I don't think that Alex Ebel spent 3 years in Guinea-Bissau training people and managing this program.
But that also speaks to the inherent problem of scalability in the sense that, and I'm sure if there's some sort of transfer of, I don't know if it's, you know, a way of thinking or management capacity between academics and, you know, in many cases, nonprofits doing this kind of stuff, you can sort of see why that, you know, why these nonprofits start to use that thinking a lot more and why they can scale with it. But imagine the same context in which academics are working directly with, say, someone in the Ministry of Education. That person may get rotated out in a year. In a lot of government ministries in these places, it's much harder to hold on to the kind of the human capital that's generated by this kind of experimentation. And that just, again, means that's just hard to build the kind of cultures around that allow this kind of stuff to thrive. Yeah.
This is something every ODI fellow knows.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, what's my takeaway from all of this here then is that, like, this is a very cool intervention. It's a very cool pair of papers. They've shown something enormous, new, and sort of inspiring in a sense. But there's a substantial amount of thinking work that still needs to go on before you understand, like, you go from two awesome papers to, and this is now what changes.
Yeah.
Is that where you've landed?
Yeah. I mean, I was, both papers are super impressive, but it needs someone to carry the torch to the next step in a way. And I'm not sure, I mean, you follow the Twitter discourse more than I have, but it's not clear that someone really is doing that.
No, I'm not sure who's there. Yeah. Right. To be that person carrying the torch, you have to put a big bet on this. And it's not clear who's got the money and the risk appetite and the willingness to move away from whatever else they're already doing to put that bet down.
I mean, if only there were these gigantic philanthropic organizations that have a lot of flexibility and the ability to move money at the slightest whim. yeah, I don't know.
I mean, William Shatner just flew to space, so I mean, there are people with money to burn.
I don't.
And the saddest thing is, he flew back.
I don't know where this should go, but I had some notes that I thought was quite funny. There is one part of the paper that bothers me a little bit. I think it's in the Gambia bit. A large section dedicated to them making sure that no one was cheating on these exams. And I found that the section weird. It's almost certainly the result of like a lot of journal referees asking for that information. But I don't know if you've seen, Randall, there's this TV special by John Cleese that came out before Monty Python was a thing called How to Irritate People. And there's a famous scene where these two pilots are bored. They're like sitting there playing I Spy with My Little Eye, like looking out the front of the airplane. And then they just decided just to start screwing around with the passengers. And so they turn on the intercom and they say, just ladies and gentlemen, just so you know, the wings are not on fire right now. And like, of course, everyone starts like looking out the window and starts freaking out. And I sort of felt that way about the paper once suddenly there was this section about cheating and I hadn't thought about it before. But the fact that the authors were suddenly very concerned about it made me a little bit worried that maybe that was an issue here, right?
Wouldn't you be? Like, so there's a point where they say something like, when we started this intervention, we had no prior belief about how successful it would be. We did not have a strong idea. And then they start getting those results that they're getting in the first cohort, right? I don't know, like, whether they were examining results as they came in or whatever, right? But if I saw those results, like, I have an experience of this recently, right? I was writing a paper and we had a cool result in one of our tables and I just sent the paper around internally to a couple of people for comments and one of my very wise colleagues who's been around longer than I have immediately wrote back and said, check that table. I don't think that anything could have, that it could possibly look like that. I mean, it's a cool result, but it's too cool. And we checked it. There was a coding problem, right? Like a really obscure coding problem, but it took a long time to uncover, right? But we discovered like, yeah, okay, so there's an interesting result still, but it's not nearly as dramatic as we first saw. My guess is that like they start seeing the results and they say, the teachers must be cheating. nothing can work this well.
Right.
And then they send somebody across to, like, you know, like, then that's when they set up the CCTV or whatever.
No, but apparently, according to the paper, the authors went and interviewed students themselves to try and get a sense if someone had shared the test. And there's a scene, I mean, to go back to Stand and Deliver, there's a scene where the students, like, score really well on this advanced placement test. And so the state school board sends these two psychometricians, one of them played by Andy Garcia, to come and, like, interrogate students to see if they've been cheating or not.
Lante, we're psychometricians. They're to the point of boring. We're not out to get anybody here.
The idea that psychometricians would be, like, going around from school to school trying to find cheats is a fun thing. The idea that Andy Garcia would be a psychometrician is also quite funny, but, you know, that reminded me of that scene. Like, yeah.
How handsome are the, you know, Texas state or whatever state it was, bureaucrats?
But no, I mean, it's interesting that the idea that intervention can be more successful than even the authors themselves could have envisioned. So, in so many ways, these papers have set a new standard for what can be possible, at least in this context of serving underserved populations.
But anyway, Matt, it was really nice to see you. What are you, how's life now you're back in the US?
The entire time, Randall, I've lived in DC, I've been carless. I didn't think it made sense to have one for a lot of it, but since the pandemic hit, I realized it would be nice to be able to kind of get out of town from time to time, and it's kind of hard to do that. Renting is a bit of a hassle. So one of my good friends in DC was leaving and selling his car on the cheap, and so I thought, you know, this is a good way to pick it up. It's a good way to pick up a car from someone I trust. The car is not what I normally would buy, but you're now looking at the owner of a 2005 Mercedes-Benz. So I feel like I've entered in midlife crisis earlier than expected by driving a Benz around. So that's the big change in my life.
Matt, you're right on time. Let's not pretend you're younger than you are.
So the fall weather is lovely. It's a good time to be out and about.
In your Benz.
In my Benz. In my Benz.
Well, okay, nothing that exciting here. Like, you know, I've got a small child. When we buy a car, it's going to be a big ass, ugly thing with a lot of boot space. Anyway, speaking of the child, I need to relieve my wife on childcare duties, and I should probably sign off now as well. But it's been great talking to you. Really interesting paper, and we promise not to leave it for another 3 months before the next one.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you everyone for your patience on us getting this one together, and we look forward to, well, we don't see you all, but we look forward to covering another paper for you in short time.
Brilliant. Bye.
All right. Bye.